All persons having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and its Honorable Court. Be seated, please. Case number 07-3027. United States of America v. Franklin A. Pettiford, appellant. Ms. Davis for the appellant.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Mary Davis. I represent the appellant, Mr. Pettiford. And with the court's permission, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for a rebuttal. I believe there are two issues that were raised that warrant argument this morning. And the first one is whether the government failed to prove that the cocaine base was either crack or that it was smokable, as required by this court's decision in Brisbane. The government presented the following facts at trial, and that is, first, that the officer Chastanet recovered a plastic bag with a white rock-like substance, a digital scale, plastic gloves, and four smaller Ziplocs, also with a white rock-like substance. The officer testified that he believed that the substance was crack cocaine based on prior arrests. The second piece of evidence presented was Detective Anthony Washington, who was an expert. He testified that the substance recovered was crack cocaine, also known as cocaine base. And he testified that crack cocaine was the same as cocaine base on three instances during his testimony. And then finally, there was a chemist report that they recovered was 18.8 grams of cocaine base of 71% purity. We submit that following the Brisbane decision, this court has, there's been four or five cases explaining Brisbane in greater detail. But no case from this circuit has found that the type of evidence presented in this case satisfied the Brisbane requirements.
Well, quite the contrary. United States versus Powell is directly on point. And in fact, the packaging, we didn't have the packaging. What we have here, which is consistent with crack cocaine, and there wasn't that evidence in Powell.
Well, I think in Powell, first the court said that the evidence wasn't exactly overwhelming, but the added factor in Powell was that the expert testified that the material was in fact crack cocaine, and he did not use the term crack cocaine and cocaine base interchangeably, as was done in this case, and I believe that's a distinguishing factor. That was in Powell. That is not in this case.
What about in Baum, where the testimony was that cocaine base was just another name for crack?
And there's the additional factor that the defendant defendant notoriety as a crack dealer, and that there was testimony by other witnesses that he was in fact a crack dealer. In this case, there was no evidence that Mr. Pettiford was a crack dealer. There was the 404B evidence of his plea in Superior Court, where he pled guilty to possession with intent to distribute cocaine. But there was not any evidence that that substance was crack cocaine. So I think that's a distinction.
Here the arresting officer said it was crack?
He said that based on his prior arrest, he thought it was crack.
And why isn't that sufficient?
Because I think any time there's a white rock-like substance and the officer says, I believe it's crack, then I think then Brisbane is reduced to basically having no import.
Well, but then isn't Brisbane really reduced to the form in which the cocaine base is? There's a rock-like form, there's a mushy form, and there's a sort of a potentially free base form. And it's unclear whether the latter two are crack, but if it's cocaine base in the rock form, that's crack.
But I think Brisbane said that there had to be evidence that it was either crack or that it was smokable. And I don't think
either one, crack or smokable.
Or smokable, right. And I don't think an officer can testify solely based on appearance that a particular substance is crack.
What else is there other than... what do you think crack is, other than that it's cocaine base in a hard rock-like form? What else is there to it?
Well, I think that there could be instances. I'm not a drug expert, but I think there could be instances where powder cocaine has in some way been altered to become hardened, but not necessarily smokable.
Fair enough, but then it wouldn't be base. Then it would be hydrochloride. If it was powder that had been hardened, maybe, then it wouldn't have been, then it would be hydrochloride. And the chemist's report here is that it's not hydrochloride.
Well, that's correct, but I think you have to, but the chemist's report here said it was cocaine base.
Right, right. So so that excludes the possibility that it's powder that's gotten hard because it's congealed somehow or something. So that's out. So what do you think crack is other than, to put it, the question, what is crack other than a rock-like form of cocaine base? What else is there to it?
I think it's the way it's been manufactured, the way it's been turned into what it is. I think.
What does that mean?
I don't know what that means.
Okay, no, fair enough. I think this is a difficult question.
Okay, but I think that there's the other cases decided by the circuit have determined that there are additional factors other than the factors presented in this case. The other issue I'd like to address is the one dealing with the sentencing. At the time when the briefs were filed, the guideline amendment had not come into effect, and there had been no decision that it be made retroactive. We're now at a point where that decision has been made, that it should be retroactive. I think the question now is what is the procedure that this court should follow? We would submit that following the decisions in the 5th, 6th, 8th, and 9th circuits, that the procedure to be followed is that the case be remanded for the sentencing judge to consider the amendment and to decide whether to apply.
In those cases, the retroactive amendment was already in effect. Here it's not in effect until March, right? March 3rd. The effective date of the amendment is not until March. I'm just reading from the sentencing.
Okay.
So in those cases, it was already in effect. And I think the courts were saying, well, since it's already in effect, there's no reason not to just send it back down. Here, it's not actually in effect until March 3rd. What's the difference, whether we remand or we don't, and we just require the defendant to file a motion?
I think the difference is that the defendant would have to file a motion.
Right.
And I think it probably would be simpler for everyone involved with the case just to be remanded for the judge to consider it, as opposed to the case.
But it wouldn't make it any more, other than the filing of additional paper, it wouldn't restrict the defendant in any way.
No, it wouldn't. It would not.
Okay.
Unless there's any additional
questions. Yeah, I have a question. What happened to the Superior Court case after the plea was withdrawn?
It goes to trial in February. It's set for trial. I think it was set for trial before, but I think it was continued, and now it's set for sometime in February.
Okay.
Okay, thank you.
Good morning. May it please the Court, Patricia Heffernan, along with Florence Pan, on behalf of the United States. With respect to the Brisbane issue, I think Judge Randolph was right. Powell is directly on point here. The evidence is even stronger than it was in Powell, because the drug packaging was consistent with street distribution, wholesale distribution, in 8-ball amounts, which is an amount of crack cocaine distributed on the street. The presence of this digital scale further corroborated the identification as crack, because the testimony established that crack dealers used digital scales to break out wholesale amounts of crack cocaine. Just briefly touching on this point about the manner in which the narcotics detective testified. First of all, there was no foundational objection to his testimony that the substance here was crack. Nobody disputed that it was cracked. It was really a foregone conclusion that it was crack. That was not the defense here, and there were no problems or objections raised to the testimony of either the police officer or the narcotics detective with respect to their identification of the substance of crack, as crack, excuse me. And I think that sort of settles the issue. The jury heard evidence that the substance was crack, and that so the evidence was sufficient, and fairly read. Really, I think his testimony is quite similar to the testimony in Baum. He was testifying based on the narcotics detective, based on his testimony, based on his experience that cocaine base is crack, which is really like saying in D.C. the cocaine base that we see is crack cocaine. But more broadly, I mean, we believe that if you have a rock a white rock of cocaine base, you have crack, because crack is a street term for a form of cocaine base usually appearing in a white rock-like substance. And I think it was the First Circuit in Robinson that explained that, that really texture and appearance is the only way of differentiating crack from other forms of cocaine base. That's what we have here, and the evidence was sufficient to prove that it was crack.
What about the smokeability? Are you saying that we should dispense with the smokeability that was being talked about in Powell, too?
I think what the court said...
In other words, if the evidence stops short, if whoever testifies stops short of getting into smokeability...
I think once we've shown crack, the government does not need to go on to also show smokeability. I think the court in Brisbane said that we know for certain that the enhanced penalty applies when the government establishes crack. It may also be the case that if the evidence doesn't show, the evidence falls short of showing that it's crack, if the evidence shows that the substance is smokable, it's possible that that too might warrant enhanced sentencing. But the court didn't answer the question in Brisbane. And it hasn't been presented or answered since then.
Yeah, there's a kind of paste that in South America, there's a cocaine paste that is commonly smoked, but there's virtually no evidence of that being used in the United States, so that possibility was left open. And the other thing, you can't smoke powdered cocaine, not because it's not cocaine-based. It is. Everything's cocaine-based. But it's because it vaporizes at a temperature that does not allow for the gas to the inhalation, whereas the crack cocaine, because of the processing, vaporizes at a lower temperature.
Yes.
Well, when you say that the way to distinguish crack is only by form, in fact, it's also could be distinguished by whether it's smokable. Right? That is, you could have testimony from a chemist about the vaporization points.
Right. That's right. We could.
Right.
But
that's not the only way. I'm not saying that you must have it, but it's not the only way to determine crack is by form.
That's right. Smokeability was one of Congress's concerns. That's right.
I guess if defense counsel had a chemist who said this was not smokable, that is, the vaporization point was not different from powder, then there would be a serious question about whether it was crack.
That's right. That would be a question for the jury, and the government would, I expect, would want to put on expert testimony refuting that expert's testimony. But, of course, that didn't happen here. But certainly that would be one way of defending a case where the government charged crack cocaine. I agree with that. Moving on to just briefly touching on the question of the sentencing remand.
I just don't know why the government, when they do the chemical analysis and they break this stuff up, and render it into kind of a powder, so that it's, why just don't do the vaporization test, you know, just to get rid of these arguments.
That's a great concern that we'll have to pass along to the DEA.
Yeah.
But for now, that's
simple.
What
it's a very simple test. Yeah. Okay.
Moving on to the question of the sentencing, whether the court ought to, we believe that just as a general matter, it's more doctrinally correct for the court simply to affirm the convictions and let appellant proceed in the district court by filing a motion under 3582 when the guideline amendment becomes the retroactive on March 3rd, once it becomes retroactively
You agree
applicable.
With the defense counsel, though, that it would make no difference with respect to what the defendant can argue below?
Absolutely.
The form of the hearing will be the same.
I agree with that. And just sort of as an aside, I would just point out that it's true that if the court were to remand with instructions to consider whether 3582 was applicable, it certainly could do that, and the appellant wouldn't have to file a motion. But under 3582, the appellant's appearance isn't even required in court.
Well,
so really, that's the way.
The appellant would still have to file a motion once it got back down the district court. This thing doesn't just happen by itself. Right. There would have to be some paper explaining why they were entitled to the reduction.
I agree with that. I thought I heard appellant saying that the one benefit to this court remanding with instructions was that he wouldn't have to file a motion, and we do think he should file a motion, and he would want to file a motion and put his arguments before the court as to why he believes he should benefit from that reduction. So we don't have strenuous objections to the court remanding with instructions that these proceedings be initiated, but we don't think it needs to do that. And since they are two entirely separate proceedings, we think that the really the more correct procedure would be for a simple affirmance here and for the appellant to file his motion in the district court and have those proceedings initiated there in the first instance.
Do you know what other circuits are doing?
I don't know, Your Honor, what other circuits are doing yet. I think there's been a lot of because a lot of offices are coordinating how to proceed, and the first concern is with defendants who have sentences who would run in their interim, who really do need to be first up at bat in terms of getting these things resolved. That's been sort of the primary concern. But we're still at such a new stage in dealing with this. I don't have an answer to that. If there are no further questions, we'd ask that the judgment be affirmed.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Unless the court has questions, I would just submit.
Thank you.
I just have one question. If your client is convicted in the Superior Court, what does that do to your argument about newly discovered evidence?
I don't think it changes it, because the argument on newly discovered evidence dealt with the voluntariness of the plea, and although technically the 404B evidence, you know, could come in another form, it could not come in as the plea.
It doesn't make it a you reverse and then have a retrial, and instead of the plea colloquy coming in, it's the fact that the conviction comes in. So, what's
there's
no difference.
I think there's a difference to the extent that you had before the jury the defendant admitting guilt to something, which I think is a little bit stronger. A little bit stronger impact on a jury than a conviction. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
You were appointed to represent the defendant.
Thank you.